This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, do Arab Americans still live in fear 5 years after 9/11? And which professions do Americans trust the least? Joining us in our New York bureau is Walter Fields, CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com. He's there with Pedro Noguera, professor in the Steinhardt School of Education at New York University. We also have economist and author Julianne Malveaux. She's president and CEO of Last Word Productions Incorporated, and she joins us from NPR in Washington, D.C. So welcome, everybody. And it seems that Americans have lost their trust in Congress. A new USA Today Gallup poll reveals that people trust lawmakers about as much as they do insurance salespeople. So 14% of adults polled gave U.S. senators high marks for honesty and ethical standards. The results were even lower for U.S. representatives. People at the top of the chart were nurses, pharmacists, and clergy. Now, to be fair, before we launch into this, Congress has never gotten over 25%, so that's kind of damning with faint praise. Anyway, Julianne, what do you think about this? Is this a reflection on what we were just hearing from Melissa Harris-Lacewell and Robert George about the do-nothing Congress?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, used car salesmen almost do better than members of Congress, which is interesting. The fact is that we got this Foley report that says, okay, we were funky, but we were not going to be, we're not going to blame anyone for being out of line. You got the Iraq study group and Congress and the president reject that. You've got a whole bunch of people who are running around behaving as if they don't have good sense. And that's really why the Democrats took over. It was not about the Democrats. It was really about disgust with Republicans. And what Democrats have the challenge to do is to try to figure out how they can juxtapose themselves from Republicans in terms of things like integrity and trust. But this report, Farai, I just sat here and laughed. I mean, it is hilarious. Used car salesmen, HMO managers, they're at the same level as members of Congress.
But Pedro, are we being too tough? I mean, you know, you take a look around at the world, there's a lot of very iffy politicians on the planet. We are not the only people. And are we grading a little bit too harshly?
I don't think so. I think that we do need to make a distinction here between the institution of Congress and individual congressmen. Most polls show that the public has a higher regard for their congressmen, but it's the institution of Congress that they don't trust at all. And I think that distinction is important because it would explain why people vote for their congressmen and then still give the Congress as a whole such a low rating. The fact that these people have to spend so much time raising money, the fact that they pretty much have to sell their souls to do it, I think puts the whole institution into disrepute. And I think that's a huge part of the problem here.
Walter, a different angle on this. Clergy ranks extremely high, but there have been scandals with clergy as well. NPR is watching one Missouri case involving a religious community in the Ozarks where girls as young as 8 might have been abused. You have the scandals in the Catholic Church. Why have clergy not been hit hard and politicians have?
Well, it's a different personal relationship to your faith than to your elected official. You know, and first of all, sympathies to all the insurance salespersons out there because, you know, when you get compared to members of Congress, it's not a good day. But, you know, there are some real structural issues, and I think Pedro just brought a few up. You know, members of Congress serve for 2-year terms. Literally, the moment that they are sworn in as members of the House, they're running for election again. And it's a very inefficient process. And for years, you know, I have been saying that we need to really look at extending the terms of members of Congress because you really can't get much done in a 2-year term, particularly if you're an incumbent and you're new to the process. So I think there are some structural barriers to having an effective Congress. But the 109th just set an amazing record as a do-nothing Congress. And I think it's going to go down in history as one of those sessions where everyone will look back and say, what were these people doing for 2 years in Washington, D.C.? Because they didn't even take care of the basic business of Congress passing appropriations bills. So we have a Congress that is ending and one that's beginning. And I think you're beginning to see the American public really question, like, what do these people really do? Because you really don't have a sense. And a lot of that's because, you know, we need to demystify the business of Congress also.
Julianne, what do you think about this proposal on, you know, that Walter brings up? extend the terms, because senators have 6-year terms, Congress people have 2-year terms. There have been Congress people who have been around for decades, but every 2 years they're running. Now, a lot of people say term limits, you know, make sure that they only serve a certain number of terms. But what do you think about the idea of extending the 2 years?
Well, I don't agree with term limits. I think term limits are elections. When you want to vote, when you're tired of somebody, you vote them out. But I do also not agree with Walter about extending the terms. I mean, you have a different kind of term situation because of the different nature of the houses of government. There are people who do not spend 24/7 raising money. You look at people like a Barbara Lee or Maxine Waters, both members of the Congressional Black Caucus, who have tremendously loyal political bases. They do raise money, but they're not doing it 24/7. And so I think that it depends on what we do. I think we could also look at ways that the feds and others can support people's congressional runs, which basically knocks some of the wealthy out or level the playing field in terms of wealth. That's something that I think makes a lot of sense. But I'm not a big fan of saying let's give them longer terms. For what? More mischief?
Pedro, what about the factor of education? I mean, civics education, and I know that you don't deal just with K through 12, but civics education in America has kind of gone by the wayside. I'm not sure how many people actually know how Congress functions. Is that a problem here?
It's a huge problem. Many people don't even know who their congressman is, and much less how it functions and what kinds of influence is being exerted by special interest and by the major corporations on the decisions being made in Congress. So I think that that's even a much larger problem. The public, general public, isn't really aware of what's happening in Congress, doesn't understand why it is that we continue to have, for example, people who are so tied to certain industries, like the oil industry or even the healthcare industry, in positions of influence and who can determine what kind of legislation is passed. So I think that's a much larger problem out here, because democracy is only as secure as the ability of the people to scrutinize and critique what's going on.
But Farai, on the issue of structure,
ahead,
though, you have to remember, first of all, there are 300 million people in the United States. Congressional districts are larger than they used to be, so you're serving a much larger district. The fact of the matter is Congress as an institution is more complex than it used to be. The committee structure is more complex. Members of Congress not only sit on committees, they sit on subcommittees and task force. What the 2-year term does to a member of Congress, it really truncates your opportunity to do real business. So while you may have some members of Congress who don't need to raise a lot of money, and usually those are members like the Congressional Black Caucus, where there is high degree of support in those districts and incumbency protection. But overwhelmingly, I would say 90% of Congress is out there raising money. They're raising money the moment they arrive in Washington, D.C. And what we've got to do is two things. I think we've got to talk about greater public financing of campaigns. But I think we also seriously need, there's no reason why you couldn't extend the term limits of members of the House, because that was set up in a situation, you know, 150 years ago, when the country was a much different place and the business of the country was much slower and less complex. We live in a different world now, and there is nothing that would prohibit extending those terms. And I think you'd have a much more efficient process.
Well, I mean, sometimes we'll have
disagree, Walter. I really, really do. I think that when you talk about efficiency, well, if you want to look at 150 years ago, why not have a president for one term? Why not do a whole bunch of other things? I mean, we could definitely go through and basically vet our entire process. But I think that there are reasons for having a 2-year Congress. And I just would not. Some of those rascals don't need to be in there but 2 years.
All right. We're going to leave that there. And I just want to make sure that in case you're tuning in, I'm Farai Chidea. This is News and Notes. We have been talking to and will continue to talk to Julianne Malveaux, who's the president and CEO of Last Word Productions, Walter Field, CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com, and Pedro Noguera, professor in the Steinhardt School of Education at New York University. Let's move along to an issue of ethnic and racial profiling. 5 years after the September 11th attacks, a lot of Arab Americans are worrying that our society equates Islam with terror. And in Detroit, some Muslims don't even shop outside of the city. Some are afraid to fly. We spoke with Rana Abbas Shami, who works at a civil rights organization in Michigan, about the unsettling trend. Michigan, of course, has a large Arab and Muslim population. And she told us about a trip her husband took this past summer.
August 10th, he was caught again in London on his connecting flight to Detroit during the terror scare. and he had to fly from London to JFK Airport. And my biggest fear was, oh my God, here's an Arab man flying during the highest terror alert level we've had since 9/11. I couldn't sleep until he arrived home safely because of concerns of what he would have to go through.
Pedro, that was Rana Abbas Shami. She's deputy director of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, talking about her husband. And this is very reminiscent, I think, for a lot of people of color, this whole issue of profiling. What does this country owe Arab Americans and Muslim Americans in terms of fair treatment? Or is this just something that is, you know, going to have to be water under the bridge in the post 9/11 world?
I think this country owes Arab Americans the same it owes all other Americans, which is to treat them fairly, to respect their rights. And all Americans, regardless of race, NAACP, the B'nai B'rith, all should be outraged that this is occurring. Because when you allow one group to be singled out this way, what you do is you open the door for all kinds of discrimination. It's not just Arabs that are being attacked now and being discriminated against. Sikhs, Indians, Pakistanis, anyone who looks remotely foreign and Middle Eastern is now subject to additional scrutiny and harassment. And I think that all of us need to be vigilant in not allowing this to occur. There are many people who think, well, these are the people who are terrorizing us, who we're at war with, and therefore it's justifiable. And that kind of thinking feeds into the racism and prejudice that will eventually be turned on many others. So I think it's very short-sighted, anyone who sits at home and says, well, they deserve it.
Walter?
Well, I couldn't agree more. And I think it also should call us to call upon our elected officials and leaders to be more responsible in the use of their rhetoric, because a lot of this is driven by that. When you hear elected officials use language that offends and that targets individual groups, I think the public feeds off of that. And now you have a very unfortunate circumstance where, you know, it doesn't even have to be an appearance. It could be a surname that sounds Arabic or Middle Eastern that will have people raise their eyebrows now. And I think it's a defining moment in a country that is seeing great demographic changes. And the United States that was just 5 years ago is not now the same country. And we need to understand the changes and we need to embrace the changes, because we're living in a global community now. And it's time that this country understand the dynamics of what's happening in a very positive way.
And Julianne, of course, Islam is one of the fastest growing, if not the fastest growing religion in the world, including among African Americans. There are a lot of people in the African American community converting to Islam. So do you think that there will be some kind of convergence of interest around this issue?
I think there has to be. I mean, I agree with both Walter and Pedro. I travel probably 200,000 miles a year, and I've seen all too often Arab American brothers and sisters being pulled out of line, being profiled. But I've also seen light-skinned black men, Mexican folks who look like they could be Arab. And I think that this creates a community of interest of people saying, just a minute, you need to explain to me why you're doing some of this. We have a whole bunch of things going on. I really listened to what the sister said about her husband and thought about a number of occurrences I've seen. But basically, what we need to do, it's not just the rhetoric, Walter, it's also the stereotypes that have seeped into our culture, into our comedy. You know, we get all upset when we talk about the N-word, but, you know, people can do anti-Islamic, anti-Arab comedy, and everybody laughs, including us.
Julianne, I wanted to make a quick transition. We don't have much time to what some people consider comedy. Final topic, an editor with a paper called The Primary Source, it's a conservative journal at Tufts University, just apologized for publishing a controversial Christmas carol. It's called O Come All Ye Black Folk, and it goes, O come all ye black folk, boisterous yet desirable. O come ye to our
please.
University. Come and
Farai.
We will admit you, born to oppression, blah, 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 52
Farai,
black freshmen.
I have a counter for them. O come all ye honkies, ignorant but ruling.
Oh, don't blow up our letter segment, Julianne.
But you know, come on now. I mean, O come ye to run our university.
All right.
You know, so come on.
The opinions expressed on this panel may not reflect the needs of management. Pedro, you're at an educational university institution. What would you say is an appropriate campus response?
You know, the there's so many layers of ignorance here in this thing. The idea that somehow black people are running the campuses, that there's preferential treatment on a campus where black students constitute less than 7% of the student body. It really makes you wonder why they would choose black students to attack, given the small numbers. And I think it speaks to a larger problem of just deep-seated racism and bigotry that's still out there. What the campus needs to do, as most campuses need to do, is make sure that they're hiring black faculty, and not just in Afro-American studies, that they are recruiting students in adequate numbers, and that they are educating all students about the growing diversity of this country. This country is going to be a majority-minority nation in a few years, and many of our universities are still not prepared to handle this major demographic change. And I think these kinds of carols and these kind of sentiments we're seeing at BU had something very similar not long ago. It's a reflection of the kind of backlash against this change.
Now, Walter, Julianne took it all the way there, but we do have to reflect that there are a lot of white students on campus who probably weren't too happy about this either.
Oh, without a doubt. But what's happened on many of these campuses is that for about a 25-year period now, the right has done an incredible job of infiltrating college campuses. And many of these journals are not just funded by universities. They get a lot of support by right-wing foundations. And many of these people, college kids who write for these journals, they end up in these think tanks around the country that are espousing far-right ideology. So we need to understand what's happening here. There's an issue of free speech, of course, and I think it has to be protected. But there's also something else that's going on. And the so-called progressive community better wake up, because it's on our college campuses where ideas percolate and they end up in the mainstream. And unless we do a counter movement to make sure that other opinions are being voiced on campuses and being funded with journals, and that students have an opportunity to rebut these views, we're going to find many of these people are people who are in policy-making positions in years to come. And there's a litany of folks now in Washington, D.C. on the right who started out as college Republicans. And it's been a movement that many of us have been sleeping on for a long time.
All right. With that last word, we've been talking to Walter Field, CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com, Pedro Noguera, professor in the Steinhardt School of Education at New York University, and economist and author Julianne Malveaux, president and CEO of Last Word Productions. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you for